Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. Take a look at our website, redicecreations.com, for regular news updates, links and resources, our radio archive, subscriber section, and much more. I'm glad you're here today. We have a very interesting guest and an interesting subject lined up. We are joined by explorer, author, and publisher David Hatcher Childress. And today we are going to spend some time talking about the Olmecs. David Childress has written quite many books on everything from lost cities, technology of the gods, to mysteries of South America's early civilizations. And his latest book is entitled The Mystery of the Olmecs. And the culture and origins of the Maya, the Aztecs, and the Incas is something that I've been intrigued with for a long time. And there are a number of lesser-known groups, tribes, or cultures in South America that probably were around before those I just mentioned, like the Chachapoyas, the Toltecs, and of course the Olmecs. I also want to mention that David Childress is one of those guys who travels around a lot. He's like a modern-day Indiana Jones, I guess, and he's got a lot of irons in the fire, so to speak. David founded the book publisher Adventures Unlimited Press back in 85 that carries a lot of great books, and if you want to take a look, just head on over to adventuresunlimitedpress.com and take a look at their online bookstore. So it's a pleasure to welcome David to the program. Thank you for coming on to Red Ice Creations Radio, David.
Hi, Frederick. Good to be on your show.
Great. It's nice to have you here. You know, you seem like a really cool guy, as I mentioned, a modern-day Indiana Jones. I don't know if that would be a good description to give people kind of an idea of who you are and what background you have in this field.
Well, I am called the real-life Indiana Jones a lot, and... You know, I like Indiana Jones. I love to travel. I like archaeology. I'm interested in esoteric things and the occult. I write, among other things, a series of books called the Lost Cities series, and it's all about lost pyramids in the jungle and ancient cities in the desert and underwater ruins and crystal skulls and all kinds of strange artifacts. So I do combine occult and esoteric things with general travel and archaeology and adventure.
Nice. You know, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background in this field and what kind of got you started looking towards these areas to begin with.
Well, yeah, and you know, I think like so many people in America and Europe who are interested in history and archaeology and adventure in the past. I was born actually in France, and my parents are Americans, though, and my father was in the American military, and my family liked to travel a lot. My father was from Colorado, so I grew up traveling and going places with my parents. Also, I grew up in the Rocky Mountains, so I was very much an outdoors skier. I liked backpacking and camping. Later, I became a mountain climber and was also interested in technical mountaineering. One of my heroes as a young boy actually was Edmund Hillary, one of the first people to climb Mount Everest. And I always was interested in Tibet, unusual places, going to the Gobi Desert. I wanted to paddle up the Amazon and go to mysterious ruins, you know, in the jungle, crossing the Sahara Desert or the Gobi Desert, things like that. I think I was lucky, really, in that... Well, many, you know, young men and women are want to go out and have adventures and travel around the world and do archaeological explorations. I was fortunate that I actually was able to go out and do those things.
Yeah.
And I began right out of high school. I graduated from high school in the mid-1970s, and I was studying Chinese, Mandarin, actually, at the University of Montana,
mm-hmm.
plus archaeology and philosophy and history. And I had the opportunity to go, actually, originally to Taiwan as an English teacher, and I dropped out of school, and I did that. And my goal at the time was to go on to Southeast Asia, and then to India, and then to Nepal, and to Kathmandu, and then go climbing in the Himalayas, and technical climbing, in fact. And I was very fortunate that I was able to do all that. And I write about that in my book on lost cities of China, Central Asia, and India.
Mm-hmm.
But that began me on a worldwide trip. I was one of the early kind of $5-a-day backpackers who I carried everything around with me in my backpack. I hitchhiked and I jumped on trains. I went across India and up to Kashmir, went to Pakistan. I even went to Afghanistan
mm-hmm.
before the Russian invasion there. I was able to hitchhike across Iran and to Turkey and Syria and Jordan. I ended up in Israel and lived on a kibbutz there as a volunteer. There I met a lot of other Europeans, and including my old girlfriend, who was from Karlskrona, Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And we then traveled into Egypt and Sudan. This began several years of traveling through Africa. During that time, I was caught in the war in Uganda with Idi Amin. there were times in Africa too. I had to carry a weapon with me.
Mm-hmm.
I was attacked once by a Tanzanian soldier who was trying to kill me, and later looted Idi Amin's house during the war. After that, I made it to Tanzania, and I was traveling, in fact, with my Swedish girlfriend at the time, and then we went to Mount Kilimanjaro, and I climbed that. That was the highest mountain in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then I continued to travel for 2.5 years through Africa, was caught up also in the guerrilla war in Sudan, finally made it into southern Africa, to Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and to South Africa, Namibia.
Yes.
Later, I hitchhiked on yachts across the Indian Ocean. A lot of this is in my book on lost cities and ancient mysteries of Africa and Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
I crewed on yachts to the Seychelles Islands, to Mauritius, and going towards Madagascar. I returned, actually, to India then, went to the Maldives and Sri Lanka, went back to Pakistan and Nepal and India. Finally, I ended up in China, where I met an old friend, an American who had been also traveling around India and Nepal in those days. And we became two of the first backpackers to go through China and travel on trains. And we went out way west through the Gobi Desert,
mm-hmm.
and up into Mongolia. And eventually I returned to the U.S. That was after nearly 6 years of traveling around the world, working, living on a few dollars a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back to the U.S. and I wrote my first book on lost cities of African Arabia, and then I was fortunate. I was able to turn my attention to South America and also to Central America, and I began traveling for years through to Peru and then Brazil, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, Ecuador, Paraguay, and other countries, and also eventually up into Central America and through Panama and Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, Belize, and Guatemala, and Mexico. And all of this took me years. I wrote this series of books. One is called Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of African Arabia.
Mm.
One is also Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of South America.
Mm.
I have a book, too, about North and Central America, which includes, in fact, parts of the United States and and Mexico. After that, I began also, you know, I have a lot of interest in even cryptozoology. I've always been interested in unusual animals and everything from Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster, now Chupacabras or whatever. And also in, you know, ancient civilizations. One of my most popular books right now is a book called Technology of the Gods, where I've written quite a bit about ancient technology, megalith building, even the idea that many ancient civilizations had electricity, other kinds of machinery, and even incredibly vimanas and like ancient aircraft and things like that.
Wow, yeah, that's so intriguing. Definitely, if we have time today, that's something I'd love to touch upon a little bit later. But you know, I would like to ask you, considering, you know, all the traveling that you have done. And I know that this is difficult to answer, of course, but is there any place that kind of stands out, you know, as a, like a favorite place of yours?
Well, you know, I'm asked that a lot, of course, and people always wanting me to tell them what my favorite place is or something like that.
Yeah.
And I honestly, I don't have any favorite place. I think different regions. I do have places around the world that I particularly enjoy, and of course, I very much like megalithic ruins, giant walls and cities, Atlantean kind of giant megaliths, and you can find those all over the world. I mean, Easter Island is, you know, even though it's a small place, has a lot of that.
Yeah.
There's another mysterious island in Micronesia called Pompeii. It has this giant city built out of basalt crystals on it. Cusco in Peru, which is the ancient Inca capital, is one of my favorite places.
I
always love going there and walking through the streets, and then the fantastic city of Machu Picchu is only a day away by train, and that's one of the great sites. I love going to Egypt, of course, and seeing those things, and then even, you know, traveling in Greece, and there's just so many fantastic places. Recently I've been going to Mexico quite a bit, and I do enjoy that a lot, and that's... That was the result of my most recent book, which is called The Mystery of the Olmecs.
So let's get into that subject a little bit and talk about more about it. You know, let's say that we know nothing of the Olmecs. What is it that makes this civilization, you know, a mystery, so to speak?
Well, the Olmecs are very little known, and even there are not very many books that have been written about the Olmecs at all. I mean, as I began doing my research over the last few years on the Olmecs, I was surprised how little has been written about them. I mean, there's really only five or six books that have been written about the Olmecs in the last 50 years since they were discovered. When we think of the Olmecs, usually the first thing that comes to mind is those giant, colossal heads that are carved out of basalt, and they look very African.
Yeah.
When you look at these giant, they're called colossal heads by archaeologists, and they weigh about 20 tons.
Jeez.
They find them mainly along the Gulf Coast of Mexico in these swamps around Tabasco. In fact, it had to do with oil exploration there in the 1940s, really, where bulldozers literally just uncovered these giant heads, and they don't look like American Indians. They look very much like Africans. They're wearing helmets. They have very wide noses and thick lips. I mean, they look really like some Nigerian rugby player or something like that. They don't look like Mayans at all. I mean, and in fact, the more you know about the Olmecs, the more mysterious they get. They They don't seem to have any special racial type. Many of them look like Africans, but other Olmecs look very Chinese, extremely Oriental, and while even other Olmecs look like they're Phoenicians or Romans or some kind of Mediterranean sailor with thick mustache and thick beards, and they're often wearing turbans. I mean, they might appear to be some kind of like Carthaginian sailor or something like that. So the more, you know, the more you find out about the Olmecs, the more mysterious they get. And now mainstream archaeologists are saying that all American Indians, including the Olmecs, yeah, they're all descendants from Ice Age hunters who walked from Siberia to Alaska, then they came down through Canada. And, you know, these people are supposedly then, Siberian hunters. American Indians actually don't have facial hair. They can't grow mustaches or beards, but many of the Olmecs do have beards and mustaches, and they don't look like American Indians. The Mayans do look like American Indians, and the whole Mayan, although many Mayans and, you know, the vessels, statues, the pottery and things like that do, I mean, they also, some of them have beards and look different, but the Olmecs particularly look very multiracial in, in some ways, a lot like America is today, where America is often called a melting pot of different ethnic groups from all over the world. We've got Africans, Asians, Europeans, and American Indians. And then Olmecs are a lot like that, too, where you have these very different racial types. But the mainstream archaeologists, you know, are saying, no, these guys aren't from Africa. There's, you know, not connections across the ocean somehow. I mean, this is what they're saying. That, yeah, these giant heads, well, they look like Africans, sure, but they're not Africans. They just kind of look like that, but if you were really a trained archaeologist, you would realize they're just American Indians, you know, the, just like all of other American Indians. They just happen to look like they're Africans. Part of the problem, Frederick, with all that, and the main theories that we get today in archaeology, especially here in the U.S. and going on in Europe, too, largely, is that archaeologists look at oceans as barriers. And according to them, you know, ancient people can't just get into a boat and cross the Atlantic or cross the Pacific going to South America or North America or something. No, people have to walk places. And so, you know, as an example, if there's some kind of, Negroid, you know, statues and villages or something in down in Mexico, well, those people didn't arrive by boat. They had to walk. They had to, and of course, I mean, they had to, somehow they walked up through Siberia. They walked all the way down through Canada. I mean, and the whole idea that these oceans are barriers, I mean, it's unscientific, really. Oceans are highways, not barriers. I mean, that's an easy way to go someplace.
Yeah, that's right.
If you're trying to go from China to Mexico, I mean, to get in a boat is a lot easier than walking thousands of miles through hostile tribes and fighting your way, you know, slowly. When in a boat, it's so much easier to go.
That's right.
But this is the big schism in archaeology right now, and it's what's known as isolationism versus diffusionism. The isolationists are the professors teaching in the universities at, in Harvard and Yale and University of New York, and they're saying that the Olmecs, the Mayans, the Incas, all these American civilizations, they're isolated from each other. They're isolated from, you know, the old world, too. I mean, not only, say, do Say Peru and the Incas, they didn't, you know, they were isolated, not just from Asia and other civilizations across oceans, but they were even isolated from, you know, North American civilizations, such as those in Mexico, or civilizations, you know, of, say, the mound builders of the Mississippi or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea that people weren't in contact, that they didn't trade with each other, that for some reason they didn't build boats, they didn't travel, you know, across any oceans or any distance. They were isolated from each other. This is what they're teaching in the universities, but the diffusionist view is totally the opposite, where even ancient cultures are in connection with each other, that transoceanic voyages of traders were going across the Atlantic, they were going across the Pacific, across the Indian Ocean,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately traveling all over the world. I mean, part of the whole idea, too, is that this is all about, in all my books, I talk about this, and books on Atlantis and Lemuria and other ancient civilizations, whether it was the Egyptians, or the ancient Hindus and Buddhists, Chinese, Olmecs, for that matter,
mm-hmm.
people just like us, even taller than us, with bigger brains, have existed, you know, for 100,000 years. People, you know, who have the same sense of adventure and curiosity, wanting to trade items, and that they would actually build boats and go places. I mean, this has been going on not for just, 1,000 years. This has been going on for tens of thousands of years.
Oh, yeah.
People building boats, people traveling across oceans. We have this, too, in the Pacific,
mm-hmm.
where you have islands such as Bali and Indonesia. I mean, at one point, all of Indonesia and out into the Pacific was a Hindu territory, and Vedic explorers, I mean, and they had to go by boat.
Mm-hmm.
They were leaving India and Southeast Asia. They were going to the many islands in Indonesia. But from there, too, they would go farther out into the Pacific. They'd go to the Solomon Islands, to Vanuatu, to Fiji, and to Tonga. From there on to Tahiti, and islands like Hawaii and Easter Island are two of the most remote islands in the world,
mm-hmm.
and yet they were populated by Polynesians. Now, the Polynesians supposedly were Stone Age people who you built these giant double canoes, put some chickens and pigs and bananas in it, and then they went out and colonized remote islands that are thousands of miles from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And Madagascar was settled in a similar way, where Malaysians from around Malaysia and Singapore, they crossed the Indian Ocean, they settled Madagascar. Again, they were some Stone Age people doing this, you know, in prehistory thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But what mainstream archaeologists are telling us is that, yes, it's okay for some prehistoric Stone Age Polynesians to get in their canoes, travel out into the middle of the Pacific, settle islands thousands of miles from anywhere, but sophisticated navies and civilizations couldn't do that. So, in other words, you know, the Egyptians, the ancient Hindus, the ancient Chinese, Vikings even, you name it, from the Basques and Moroccans, Romans, Greeks, all of these countries had huge navies, giant ships that they sailed.
Mm.
They took them, you know, all over the Indian Ocean. They went out into the Atlantic. They had ships much bigger than any ships that Columbus had or early Portuguese explorers.
Mm.
But even though these sophisticated, so-called sophisticated civilizations, with their giant navies, they can't go out into these islands. They can't go out and cross the Atlantic or go out into the Pacific to Hawaii.
Mm.
No, only Stone Age people from thousands of years ago. They can do it.
Mm.
So, I mean, these are the kind of arguments that I am constantly fighting against in my books. Much like the famous Norwegian explorer and archaeologist Thor Heyerdahl. I met him one time in Peru. And to me, I'd always read his books when I was younger. And he was a big hero of mine. And he will sadly be missed. But, he also, like me, tried to argue that ancient people with boats and a sense of adventure would get into boats, and they would cross oceans, and they would go places. And he, of course, is famous for having built some reed boats and balsa wood boats to cross the Atlantic, and then he made one famous, the Contiki voyages, where he also went out into the Pacific, leaving from Peru.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And we have, you know, these small traces here and there, like they find traces of, coca leaves and in, you know, Egyptian tombs and things like this, indicating that there were some communication between South America and Egypt, right?
Well, that's right. And in fact, German University, some 10 years ago or so, they were able to find traces of coca leaves and tobacco leaves in Egyptian mummies in the resin and embalming mixtures that they would use. And what that German university realized as they identified those substances is that coca leaves only come from South America. They don't even grow in North America. And tobacco is also an American plant. It grows in North and South America. But that both these plants only come from the Americas. So if there were these substances in Egyptian mummies, then that would indicate that the Egyptians, you know, were in transatlantic contact and even possibly trans-Pacific contact with North and South America. As a matter of fact, I mean, it's interesting to look at mummies, and in my books I often talk about the mysteries of mummification and why. And the oldest mummies that have ever been found, actually, are found in South America. And those mummies are found in northern Chile, along the Atacama Desert. Even there's a museum in Arica, Chile, that has these mummies. And some of those mummies, according to archaeologists in Chile, some of these mummies go back to almost 9,000 B.C.
Sheesh.
I mean, that's 11,000 years ago.
Yeah.
That is 5 or 6,000 years older than any known Egyptian mummies. And other mummies, too, are found in Central Asia, found in Mongolia and Kazakhstan, the Altai Himalaya Mountains, where they find these red-haired mummies, which is unusual,
yeah.
As we think of China and Mongolia as being not being occupied really by red-haired people. So, you know, you have this whole idea of how old civilization is. So much of what we're taught, really, of Sumeria being, say, the oldest civilization, when in fact, you know, many archaeologists now are realizing that civilizations like Egypt, ancient India, also as an example, are actually older than ancient Sumeria. And ultimately, you know, civilization is being pushed back thousands and thousands of years. And this is something that's happening all the time in archaeology, is that we're realizing that civilization and the people who are out there building roads and bridges, pyramids, giant cities, all this goes back for thousands of years, much older than we ever thought. And if really the whole story of Atlantis is about these ancient civilizations, if civilization is really over 10,000 years old, then it's going back to before the last ice age. And, well, the mainstream archaeologists are basically saying No, you know, in the last ice age, people were still cavemen, living their caves. But then, around, you know, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, people just stepped out of their caves, started building these giant megalithic cities, giant pyramids, roads and bridges and things like that. But really, civilization goes back before that. I mean, I maintain in my books that civilization goes back 15,000, 20,000 years, even more than that. And if civilization is that old, then, you know, we don't really have a name for it except for Atlantis. I mean, that's what we might as well call it, something like that. And I think Atlantis is a good name.
Yeah, and I mean, I just want to ask you here, I mean, so with these ancient mariners in mind that seem to almost have like a global civilization, or at least a communication of you know, a global network, so to speak, what happened to upset this communication? I mean, we have the Inquisition, or was there some kind of cataclysm involved here? What do you think?
Well, right. I mean, that's a good question. Yeah, something happened there, and it's probably happened over and over again, and it can be a combination of a lot of different things. One of the things that's going on like that, and the Olmecs is a similar situation. Imagine this for a minute. Let's say there's some cataclysm in the near future, and the world was sent back to the Stone Age, and then after 500 or 1,000 years, archaeologists, civilization came back, and archaeologists were digging up Sydney, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just some ruined city, and as the archaeologists did more and more excavations and discoveries in Sydney, Australia, they suddenly came to the amazing conclusion that these people in Australia spoke the same language as these people in this small little island in the North Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And that island is called England. And so here's this little island in the North Sea, and on the opposite side of the world, nearly as far away from England as you could possibly get, is this remote, weird city called Sydney, Australia, and archaeologists, you know, determined that those people, they weren't from Indonesia or from India or from Vietnam or somewhere near to them. No, those cultures weren't related to Sydney, Australia. Their cultural homeland was on the other side of the earth in this small island country.
Wow.
And, I mean, archaeologists would be amazed that they couldn't believe it. I mean, why weren't people from Indonesia, why wasn't it their culture in Sydney, Australia? I mean, it's the same kind of a thing we're looking at. I mean, so, yeah, this small island of England sent boats to the other side of the world, colonized this, you know, remote corner of the world, and, you know, they spoke the same language, their culture was all the same. But then, let's say something happened. In this case, England was destroyed, and a giant tidal wave or earthquake wiped out London and all the port cities in England. And so, I mean, today we have, you know, super tankers and giant 747 airplanes flying all over the world, stopping in Singapore. But say this has all happened, you know, before all that, and England was wiped out. So suddenly all the ships that used to go every year to Sydney, they just stopped going. And the people in Sydney waited for the ships to come from England, but they didn't come. And so suddenly those people are isolated. The homeland where they had originated from has been destroyed. Even they don't know what happened. Or perhaps, you know, some ship does make it to Sydney and tells the story of how their little island in the North Sea was destroyed. They're not going to be sending any more supplies. No more books will be going to Sydney, you know, for people to read. And it's that kind of a thing. So when you have, and this part of the thing with the Olmecs, as I say in my book, The Mystery of the Olmecs, one of the things that's going on there is that the Olmec territory is this very narrow part of Mexico, which is known as the Isthmus of Tehuantepec.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, if you look at a map, this is, as Mexico narrows to a V down at the bottom, there's a very narrow little part, and it goes, it is exactly the Olmec territory.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that they found about the Olmecs, and the Olmecs are really going back 3,500 years ago, back to about 1,300 BC or so. This is some of the oldest Olmec statues. And also, by the way, the Olmecs are now credited with the invention of just about everything that the Mayans were originally said to have invented, including the number system,
really?
The Mayan hieroglyphs,
wow.
The rubber balls, the ball courts. The Mayans were famous for playing these ball games.
Mm-hmm.
Even the building of the pyramids and all the early Mayan cities. Now, archaeologists are saying, well, the Olmecs originally built all those things. The Mayans
really
took it all over in the end, around 500 BC.
Well, that's right, because, you know, that was one question I did want to ask you, you know, because there are a lot of, you know, legends or accounts in both the Mayans and the Aztec and Incas that they weren't themselves the original builders, you know, of many of these cities and monuments and pyramids and so forth. So, okay, you're saying that this actually is beginning to be recognized, and now the Olmecs are the origin builders of these.
That's right, that's right. So now, I mean, what archaeologists are realizing is that, yes, the Mayans originate from the Olmecs. Almost everything the Mayans have and had in ancient times came from the Olmecs, from the food, the jade mines, the ceramics, the art, the cocoa seeds, which were used as money, even ancient mining and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
is all credited now to the Olmecs. Even the number system that we use, and the calendar.
Really?
So even like now, that we're talking about the Mayan calendar ending in the year 2012. Well, that came from the Olmecs.
Well, you know, there is this legend of in Mayan culture of a guy called Itzamna, and allegedly he's actually more Caucasian looking, according to, you know, what they described him as. So, I mean, could this be an Olmec, you know, as the origins of the Mayan calendar, I mean, here?
Well, yeah, sure. And one of the things you have to understand, now, we know so little about the Olmecs that we don't know what their own beliefs were and whether they had different myths like the Mayans, but they probably did.
Mm.
And we know, though, you know, from Mayan texts like the Popol Vuh, the Chulalm Balam. Mayans still exist today in Guatemala,
sure.
and parts of Mexico. The Olmecs are completely gone, and there there really are not Olmecs anymore, whoever they were.
Mm.
But the Mayans still exist, and you know, even though large areas of the Petén jungle in northern Guatemala and other areas, huge, vast areas of just where no one lives, and there's literally thousands and thousands of cities and pyramids out there, and even today, hardly anyone lives in this area. But there are still areas where the Mayans do still live. But the Mayans believed, like, and later the Aztecs and also the Hopi Indians of Arizona also believe this, that the world has been destroyed four times over. And this was, you know, part of the Mayan myth and legend, and it must have come from the Olmecs, how the world was first destroyed in fire, then it was destroyed by ice, then it was destroyed by water, and each time there's been these terrible destructions of the world, and then the gods would basically, you know, clean off the earth, and a few people would survive, very much like Noah and the Ark kind of stories.
Yeah.
And then the earth gets repopulated again. There are, you know, the cities are rebuilt. And even part of, you know, Mayan and Aztec myths and legends have a lot to do with giants who were building the world before and then they were destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And that today we are supposedly living in the fifth world now. And it, too, will be destroyed soon. And then we'll enter into another world.
That's right.
But even the destruction of the Olmecs, I suggest in my book, is whatever happened to them, and there possibly had to do with some volcanic changes, some tidal waves also that probably hit the Pacific coast, and suddenly, the Olmec world would just disappeared essentially, and I mean it wasn't the end of civilization there, but that civilization collapsed, and what took its place were the Mixtecs, the Zapotecs, and the Mayans,
mm-hmm.
who then really began their ascendancy there in Mesoamerica. And then finally, the Aztecs. And the Aztecs themselves are very recent to us, and a lot of people don't realize that, but the Aztecs only had existed for just a few hundred years prior to the European invasion of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly with the Incas as well. The Incas also had only existed as a civilization just a few hundred years before the Spanish got there.
Hmm. Wow. You know, and again, there are these, you know, amazing sites, like take Teotihuacan, for example, in Mexico. And again, if you read the accounts there, it seems like this was built way, way, way before. And then, you know, after a series of different people coming and going out of that region, the Aztecs or the Incas, I'm not sure there, moved in eventually and took over that area. And then, of course, the Spanish and the Portuguese came over and discovered them there. But, I mean, talking again about the building itself of these monuments and structures.
And that's a really good point. And particularly in Peru, you see this also in Mexico with Tenochtitlan and things like that. And Cusco, you had asked me earlier about, you know, my favorite places, and mm-hmm. I was saying how Cusco in Peru is one of my favorite places. When you're in Cusco and you're walking around, it is a megalithic city. I mean, it's a city that is built out of huge blocks of stone and perfectly fitted together. It's quite amazing. And even these buildings are restaurants and hotels and little shops today around Cusco.
Mm.
And the Spanish have built some new buildings there and churches, but many of these old buildings are there. So it's really kind of interesting. When you look at, say, Cusco, today Spanish people are living in these buildings, but they didn't build them. Those buildings existed before they ever arrived in Peru.
Yeah.
So what modern archaeologists say is like, oh, well, the Incas built those cities only a few hundred years, like 200 years before the Spanish got there.
Yeah.
Yet when you see those buildings, and they're the same buildings that are at Tiwanaku in Bolivia, and they know that those are pre-Inca buildings. So, I mean, what I maintain in my books is that just like the Spanish today are occupying and living in buildings that were built before them,
mm-hmm.
the Incas did the same thing. And the Incas were living in those buildings when the Spanish came, but they didn't build those buildings. They were already there because they're built out of giant blocks of stone. I mean, it can't be destroyed. Even the Spanish, would like to dismantle these buildings if they could, but they weren't really able to. They were so well built and with such large blocks of stone. I mean, the Spanish did alter the buildings. The roofs were changed and things like that. They would put new doors into walls wherever they could. But essentially, these ancient buildings are still standing there today.
Mm.
People are still living in them, but they didn't build those buildings.
And there is another thing that is quite amazing here. You know, the technology of how they actually, you know, developed this. You know, it's like seamlessly these stones have been carved and then placed. And one of the advantages of this, of course, is that these structures are kind of earthquake resistant, meaning that the buildings that we build today, you know, shatter, you know, almost, you know, instantly if there's a powerful enough earthquake. But these stone structures actually can withstand this because of the way the stones have been carved and then placed. So this is like the structure is holding up itself, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, those kind of buildings, like the ones in Peru, they are the most sophisticated form of building, and that's because these giant blocks of stone are locked in together. And even though they're huge blocks of stone, you would think they wouldn't be going anywhere, but they still lock them together like a jigsaw. When you build with, say, bricks, and when you're building structures that are made out of uniform, you know, pieces, like a brick, or even, say, just larger stones. Mm-hmm. But if they're all the same size and rectangular, and you just have kind of layer upon layer, and this is how the Spanish built, too, in, say, Cuzco, when they built the early cathedrals and stuff, they built it the old Spanish style. It's not as well built as the earlier megalithic buildings. But when the shock wave of an earthquake hits those buildings, they shear. And because they're built in these layers, yeah, they can't really withstand the big earthquakes. So that they're moving, the walls fall down. But the ancient building has, because of the jigsaw pattern, these giant blocks are locked together. Mm. So even when the wave of an earthquake hits it, and there's no mortar used either, the blocks will move together so that they can shake briefly. But because they're locked in together, the whole wall comes back together and remains standing, even, you know, in the force of giant earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the most sophisticated kind of building. I mean, this is the kind of thing, when you see buildings in Egypt, other ancient buildings in Greece, also in India, Indonesia, on Pacific Islands, in Peru, there are megalithic buildings in Mexico, too. I mean, these buildings, they are made to last for thousands of years, and they have.
Yeah.
you know, when we build things today, I mean, there's almost planned obsolescence in capital cities in Europe and America. I mean, there are some very well-built buildings with big stones and things like that.
Mm.
But even those buildings are only meant to last for a few hundred years, really,
not for
thousands of years,
yeah,
like the ancients built things.
Wow, and there is one more thing here. I think the area is called Sacsayhuaman. Is that
Sacsayhuaman? Yeah, that is the giant megalithic fortress above Cuzco on the hills up there. Yeah.
And one thing I guess that I've heard you talk about before is kind of the way of how the heck they actually did get the stones up there itself, because the quarry is way off, if I remember correctly.
Well, that's right. And also at Tiwanaku, the quarries are like, many miles away. So particularly in South America, and as well as in Mexico and Central America, you have a problem because, according to mainstream archaeologists, you know, the Incas were very primitive. They didn't know the wheel. They didn't know writing, supposedly. You know, they were lacking many of the basics of civilization, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, when they built things, they were superb engineers. I mean, and you have to ask why.
Mm-hmm.
Why would anyone go around building out of giant blocks of stone, you know, the size of a semi-truck? You don't have to do that. I mean, we don't do that today.
Yeah.
I mean, we have big cranes and things like that, trains and ships to haul material around, but we do not make that kind of effort to build out of blocks of stone that weigh 50 tons or 100 tons. There's no reason for it. But yet, these ancient people did build like that. And you have to ask why. I mean, did they want to build, you know, something that was almost impossible, you know, to make? Yet they made it.
Yeah, and to me, I mean, this suggests that these people actually wanted something that could last, something that actually could take the pounding of either if it was earthquakes or, you know, flooding or whatever. This, to me, suggests that they had been involved in some tremendous, you know, cataclysm, some traumatic experience, basically.
You know, and when you see Tiwanaku, which is on the southern shore of Lake Titicaca in Bolivia. And you see the amazing ruins there, and the archaeologists admit that's pre-Inca, even though, and you know, and it's from, you know, some thousands of years ago at least. But you see the ruins there, and they are destroyed. I mean, they are these giant blocks of granite, and they are just thrown around by some cataclysmic destruction, many of them buried. I mean, something happened there to destroy those giant buildings, and it must have been quite a cataclysm.
Oh my gosh, yeah, wouldn't like to, you know, live through that again. And as you say, this is a constant recurring theme in the mythologies of not only the cultures of South America, but other cultures as well, that there are these, again, these cycles coming and going, destructions of different kinds. And if I remember correctly now, I think that the Mayans have this legend that our current world, if this is the fifth, I think that this will end in fire. Many people have related this to the sun itself, and you know, the solar radiation increasing and all of this. Do you have any idea or take on this?
Well, you know, I'm familiar with many of those stories, and I mean, this is kind of all part of the thing too, is that apparently, you know, there are many cataclysms that come and go, from volcanic eruptions to tidal waves and tsunamis, and even to, yeah, the sun sending out super flares that fry the earth. In many ways, we've been quite lucky. I mean, you look at civilization today. I mean, we're only about 200 years old. All of the things we have now, you know, so modern, and space flight and everything. But it's only happened the last couple of hundred years.
Yeah.
And in this last few hundred years, I mean, the Earth has been relatively quiet. There have been some volcanic upheavals and tsunamis and things like that. But really, we've been lucky that most of the world has escaped, you know, a lot of destruction. But yet, you know, that may be a cyclical thing, and quite possibly we're way overdue for something to happen.
That's right. You know, we're quickly running out of time here, but, you know, before we end the segment here, I would like to, you know, tell people how they can get your new book, and for that matter, tell them, you know, some of your previous books that you have out there also.
Yeah, right. Well, my new book, The Mystery of Olmecs, and all my books can be found on our website at adventuresunlimitedpress.com. It's also available at amazon.com and other sites, amazon.co.uk as well. I'm the author of over 20 books. They're all published by Adventures Unlimited Press. I've written the Lost Cities series. There's 6 books in that. I wrote a book called A Hitchhiker's Guide to Armageddon. My book, Technology of the Gods, has been translated into quite a few foreign languages, French, German, other languages. I'm also the author of books on Nikola Tesla, on anti-gravity. I did a book on the extraterrestrial archaeology, all about structures on the moon and Mars. And also write about the Templar fleet, and one of my popular books is a book called Pirates and the Lost Templar Fleet.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, so I mean, so everybody do take a look. It's adventuresunlimitedpress.com to pop in there and take a look at the online bookstore that they have there. And again, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program, David. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
You have been listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. David and I will continue talking in our subscriber section, and we're going to get into the technology of the gods, ancient flying machines, vimanas from Hindu mythology, crystal technology and the crystal skulls, electricity in the ancient world, and ancient atomic warfare. Absolutely fascinating material that you don't want to miss. Stop by our website, redicecreations.com, and check out our subscriber section on how to sign up and tune in. We have a 3-month subscription option available, and you'll get full access to our growing radio archive. You can easily sign up with PayPal, or take a look at our alternative payment methods in case you don't want to use PayPal. Many thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren, and thank you for listening. This is Henrik Palmgren. Until next time, take good care.